This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we start with a report of how big oil companies have been issuing false reports on the damages, economical as well as environmental, caused by their use of their fossil fuels.
Our guest from the Center for Climate Integrity will describe how lawsuits all across America are now seeking to force the oil companies to pay their fair share of these astronomical costs. Next, we're joined by the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center to discuss geofence warrants. No one knows what they are, but we'll tell you.
Companies such as Google use these warrants to track your geolocation data, where you are, at what time, and for how long.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Today, we're delving into a legacy of deception and destruction. Because for more than 50 years, big oil companies like ExxonMobil, Chevron, and BP have known that burning fossil fuels would raise global temperatures. And yet, instead of taking responsibility or warning the public, they've orchestrated campaigns of denial, disinformation, and delay. As a result, we are living with unprecedented climate disasters. Following the hottest year on record in 2023, extreme weather events have, well, intensified. From record-breaking wildfires, scorching California and Canada, to catastrophic hurricanes pounding the Gulf Coast. During this past June, nearly 5 billion people globally faced intense heat over 9 days, with more than 60% of the world's population encountering temperatures made at least 3 times more likely by climate change. These events not only devastate ecosystems and communities, they also cost taxpayers millions, and then finally billions of dollars when you add it all up in damage and recovery. Our guest today is Corey Rede-White, managing attorney at the Center for Climate Integrity, an organization that is fighting to hold big oil accountable for its deceit. The center is supporting litigation efforts in several states, aiming to force fossil fuel companies to pay for the damage they've caused. Let's hear more about their approach and how the legal system might be used to confront this ongoing climate crisis. Well, Corey Rede-White, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Corey, let's start this way. In a nutshell, how do you want to explain to our listeners, describing really the scale and the cost of the climate damage that we're witnessing today?
Yeah, it's substantial. It's, of course, not possible to put an exact number on it, but we've certainly seen some informed estimates. So, like on the macro level, a study from Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research found that globally, climate change could cost $38 trillion per year by the year 2050. And on a more personal level, a report recently put out by Consumer Reports found that climate change could cost each American born today $500,000. So the reality is that every community across the world, but focusing here today on the U.S., is paying the price for climate change. That's, you know, protecting infrastructure from rising seas, from floods, protecting their residents from extreme heat and superstorms, keeping schools cool enough now so they can stay open for the students to learn. All of these and many more are climate costs. Sometimes they're hidden and sometimes they're very obvious. But for individual communities, we're talking billions of dollars that are going to need to be spent to adapt to our changing climate. So some of my colleagues at the Center for Climate Integrity have worked on putting together some estimates in different localities. Like they did one report in Pennsylvania where we identified $15 billion in municipal costs that'll have to be spent by the year 2040. And these are for all sorts of impacts, but not nearly all of them. Just as one example, installing and upgrading the air conditioners there will cost Pennsylvania schools about $1.23 billion over the next 15 years. In Wisconsin, where we estimated that municipalities will have to spend at least $16.7 billion to address just a handful of the common climate adaptations, taxpayers there are going to face $6.67 billion through 2040 to improve stormwater management to mitigate floods from the more intense storms. So that's just an idea of some of the costs we know that are going to be needed over the next, you know, just couple decades.
Now, Corey, those are astonishing numbers, but equally astonishing, I think, is the decades-long misinformation campaign of big oil that has really brought us or contributed deeply to this disaster. Can you give us a description of how that started and what their misinformation campaigns have been?
Yeah. Thanks, Heidi. Nice to be on with you. The easiest way to say it is they stole critical time from us. It wasn't until the impacts of climate change were absolutely undeniable that big oil finally told the truth about the dangers of their products. And you can imagine the action, the preparation that communities could have invested if the fossil fuel companies hadn't spent decades muddying the waters and stalling out climate action. So, you know, instead of acting on the knowledge they had, these corporations launched a campaign of deception, really like one we've never seen before. They spent millions of dollars telling the public that climate science was unclear, while privately they prepared their infrastructure for the very changes that they knew were coming, the very changes we're seeing now. So you have to remember that these oil companies, they were some of the first to research the greenhouse effect or climate change. Back in the 70s, Exxon and some of the other major fossil fuel companies hired scientists to research what is this greenhouse effect. And they, of course, found that the burning of their fossil fuels would raise carbon dioxide levels and ultimately lead to the climate impacts we're seeing today. The misinformation campaign was extremely successful, unfortunately, and has, of course, made everything a lot more severe now and urgent now than it needed to be.
You know, speaking of misleading information and campaigns about it, my neighbors, because I've talked about this with them recently, are of the impression that, well, now, yes, there's all this bad plastic stuff, but we recycle it now, and we keep it in separate containers. They're a different color even, and so forth and so on. Well, the Center for Climate Integrity, though, has issued a report, and it's called The Fraud of Plastic Recycling. So would you explain, Corey, how big oil and the plastics industry have, in fact, duped the public and caused what you call the plastic waste crisis?
Yeah, I'm glad you saw the report. It is a groundbreaking one that has opened a lot of eyes to the plastic waste fraud. So, you know, many people don't even realize that plastics are actually made from fossil fuels. And many of the world's largest oil companies are also the world's largest plastics producers. So just as these same companies like Exxon and Shell knew and lied about how their products would cause climate change, it turns out they and the other members of the petrochemical plastics industry knew decades ago that their plastics could never really truly be recycled. You know, because of the economic and technical limitations, only about 5% of all plastics in the U.S. get recycled each year. The rest of it ends up in landfills or incinerators or just in our environment. But they knew that in order to keep selling us more and more plastics, that big oil and the petrochemical industry, they knew they had to sell the public and policymakers on this idea that recycling could solve the problem of plastic pollution. And of course, that pollution is now everywhere, even in our bodies, in the form of microplastics. So just like they lied about climate change, they lied about plastic recycling through PR campaigns, advertisements, and more. And yeah, as you referred to, this report we issued earlier this year, the fraud of plastics recycling, it lays out new evidence that we think could provide the foundation for legal efforts to hold the fossil fuel industry and other petrochemical companies accountable for this recycling deception and the significant damage it's caused. And I'll just note one more thing that for the last 2 years, California Attorney General Rob Bonta has been investigating the role of the fossil fuel and petrochemical industries in this plastic pollution crisis. As a part of that investigation, he subpoenaed ExxonMobil, the largest producer of single-use plastic polymers in the world. And in the spring, AG Bonta said they were getting ready to conclude that investigation and announce next steps.
Can, in fact, plastic waste be recycled? Is it simply that they didn't bother to do it and dupe the public that way? Or is it that it can't be done? Which is it?
It's not that it can't ever be recycled at all. It's that the representations they made about the feasibility of recycling in order to sell us more plastics were completely deceptive and false. So there is 5% of the plastic in this country does actually get recycled. It can't be recycled over and over again. So in that sense, it's not truly being recycled, but it can be reused. Certain plastics, and it is a small number of them, can be recycled into another form of plastic. Otherwise, what they often try to call recycling is just burning it and turning it into a fuel that they can use. It's not actually recycling it into another plastic product.
Tell us about the center's so-called deception documents and what evidence shows that oil companies knew about the harmful effects of their products on the climate, yet actively chose to mislead the public.
Yeah, we really have to give thanks to the incredible work of investigative journalists who, for the past 10 or so years, have been able to uncover this evidence that really will be pivotal in holding this industry accountable. So the documents that have been made publicly available, they range from internal industry reports and company communications detailing when and what they knew about climate change, to public speeches and advertisements that show how they were talking about climate change to the public. So just a couple of documents that I like to reference because of how egregious they were. You know, there's a 1978 memo from an Exxon researcher named J.F. Black that found, quote, "Man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical." And then in the now infamous 1982 internal reports, Exxon scientists predicted that the atmospheric CO2 concentrations by the year 2020 would be at 420 parts per million, which is exactly what they ended up being in 2020. So back in 82, they were able to, within a part per million, predict where we'd be at with this oversaturation of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. They knew. And then Shell has an entire confidential report from 1988 on the greenhouse gas effect that concludes that the burning of fossil fuels is leading to global warming and that, quote, "by the time the global warming becomes detectable, it could be too late to take effective countermeasures to reduce the effects or even stabilize the situation." So again, it's not just that they knew their products were going to cause climate change. They understood the latency on when we would see those impacts. All the more egregious then that they wouldn't say anything about it and let us make an informed decision as a society. So a lot of the kind of more recent docs that have been uncovered have come through investigations into the oil and gas industry done by Congress. We've first seen the House and now the Senate investigations into, you know, what the industry knew and what public statements they were making. And I'll just end by noting that while we do have thousands of pages of documents showing big oil's active role in deceiving the public, oil companies have spent a lot of time resisting to comply with records requests and subpoenas, or when they do produce documents, they've been heavily redacted. So once these companies are forced to produce evidence through discovery, you know, which is, of course, the heart of civil litigation, I expect we'll learn a lot more.
Another piece of wonderful work that the Center for Climate Integrity supports as litigation against these oil companies that are taking place in various states. What kinds of communities are bringing these legal challenges, and what are essentially their legal arguments when they do so?
Yeah, so really communities across the country of all kinds, all political backgrounds and sizes, from California to Minnesota to Delaware, cities from Charleston, South Carolina to Honolulu, Hawaii, to Hoboken, New Jersey, communities in Puerto Rico, tribal governments in the Pacific Northwest, they've all filed some version of a they knew, they lied, they should be held accountable type lawsuit. And so, you know, these lawsuits are governments realizing that there's a delta between what they have in their budget and what their current and near future climate adaptation costs are going to be. So when they actually look at these staggering numbers, they tend to ask, well, how did this happen? How did we get here? And once you start to pull that thread, once you start to realize that there's one industry that over the last several decades has made trillions of dollars selling us a product, and that product is causing harms that over the next several decades are going to cost governments trillions of dollars to address, the question of who should pay becomes really as sobering as it is obvious. And these lawsuits are about that. Who should pay these costs? So they're a lot like other lawsuits we've seen that have come before, like the tobacco litigation, or more recently, the opioid litigation. They are seeking some combination of damages, statutory penalties, and injunctive relief. They first want to bring an end to the deception, to bring truth back into our advertising and our social discourse. And secondly, they aim to recoup the costs that the oil and gas industry has shifted onto the backs of taxpayers. So they want the court to order them to give money to help pay for the adaptation we need to create in communities across this country as a result of the climate crisis.
With the tremendous amount of money that the oil companies can put toward litigation, what is the chance of success for some of these more grassroots communities bringing their own legal challenges?
Well, you know, the communities aren't doing it alone. They are, almost all of them, hiring outside counsel on a contingency fee basis. And I'll just make clear here, you know, CCI, we support this litigation. We track it closely. We do a lot of education around the issues here. We don't actually litigate the cases ourselves. We don't represent any of these parties. There are plaintiffs' firms that have a background, be it in toxic torts, opioids, asbestos, other examples of, you know, the Monsanto litigation, going after massive industries, using tort claims, using consumer protection claims, and they have success in that. And they are now taking on these cases, again, at no upfront cost to the communities, and they're prepared to go after industry. And I can get into the evidence and the reasons why they think they can be successful. But the fact of the matter is, thus far, they have had some early success, at least in fighting off some of the jurisdictional battles, and in some cases, getting past motions to dismiss.
Could you give us one example of any success stories?
Yeah, again, none of these cases have gone to trial yet. So the ultimate objective has not been met, nor has it had any sort of demise. But we have seen, like in Honolulu, their case, the lower court denied all of defendants' motions to dismiss the case. It was immediately appealed all the way up to the state Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court wrote a fantastic opinion affirming the lower court's denial of those motions to dismiss and really preparing that case to head to discovery. Now, defendants in that case have asked the Supreme Court to grant cert and look at that opinion, and we're waiting to see whether or not the Supreme Court will grant that cert. The Supreme Court has asked the U.S. Solicitor General to weigh in on the issue before they decide whether or not to grant cert.
Well, Corey, when you've indicated to us already the almost unbelievable cost, and not simply in the effect on human lives and on the health of the planet, but actual dollar cost as a result of the damage done by these fossil fuel companies. I'm hard-pressed to find an example of when the kind of damage these oil companies do and fines that they receive bear any resemblance to one another. The damage they do often seems 10 times or 100 times greater, in fact, than any fines that are put on them. And I'm wondering if that's true as well with the lawsuit. So, and of course, the big oil companies themselves claim, we're simply, those plaintiffs that are suing us are simply trying to shift the blame, shift it away, you know. It's really the consumers who use their products who are to blame. So how do you and the Center for Climate Integrity respond to this kind of framing? And what can you tell us about whether any results from these lawsuits on the plaintiff in terms of damages come anywhere close to equaling the damage that they're suing over?
It is hard to hold an industry this big accountable, but it is not impossible, and it is certainly the role of our judicial branch to do just that. I think what makes these cases different is the evidence and the science. So the evidence of that deception, which we discussed earlier, and it really started to come out publicly about 10 years ago, 2014, 2015, and it was around that same time that we saw publications of really game-changing advances in climate attribution science, including the work of Dr. Richard Heaty. And it's so, you know, with these documents showing evidence of their deception, and with this attribution science allowing us, like never before, to attribute harm to defendants, we never before have had a better understanding of what this industry did and how exactly to attribute the harm they respectively caused than we do right now. And that's a big difference that I do think will allow us in court to get a better equitable judgment from them with regards to the harm they've actually caused. In terms of this industry argument about trying to shift the blame away from themselves onto consumers, yeah, obviously this is a global climate crisis. It is not one person or one industry's entire fault. But it's worth noting, you know, the concept of a personal carbon footprint that I'm sure we're all familiar with today, that was actually created by a PR firm for BP, you know, British Petroleum. You know, of course they want to deflect the blame. Ever since these companies started publicly recognizing the reality of climate science back in the early 2000s, they've been pushing this idea that we are all responsible for climate change, whether it's because we drive cars to work or we use fossil fuel gas to heat our homes. But can we truly blame people for using the energy sources that are available to them? I mean, in reality, it was the fossil fuel companies who knowingly contributed to the climate crisis for decades. Remember, for, you know, crucial years there, they explicitly told the rest of us that we were not contributing to the crisis because, contrary to their internal knowledge, their public position was there was no crisis at all. They are the ones that have made trillions of dollars from selling us their products while ensuring that we, over these pivotal decades, had virtually no choice but to use them. And even now, even while alternative forms of energy are finally starting to really come online and consumers are starting to be able to make their own informed choices, this gaslighting continues. You know, the oil companies say they're committed to the goals of the Paris Agreement, but at the same time, they're increasing their oil production, which is, of course, in direct conflict to the Paris goals. So, again, at the end of the day, all these lawsuits are doing is that demanding big oil stop lying, acknowledge its massive climate deception, and pay its fair share of the climate damages that they knew their products were going to cause.
Corey, we're running out of our allotted time. I guess a final question would be, is there hope for more legal challenges like this? And we here in Law and Disorder know that bringing issues into the public fore through litigation is an essential component in changing the minds and the awareness of citizens. If we have more lawsuits, what kinds of legal challenges are these communities facing as we go forward?
You know, we are just one organization that is interested in supporting climate litigation. There are many organizations working on many different types of climate litigation. Climate crisis is big. It's multifaceted. It's going to take work on all fronts. We need to mitigate against the emission of further greenhouse gases. And there is climate litigation that is aimed at climate mitigation. And then, like the climate litigation we support, there's adaptation that we know needs to happen no matter what happens on the mitigation side. So there are lots of folks working on the different facets here. We stay really in our mission of holding this industry accountable for their deception. And any efforts that are done to that end, we want to support. I think if we can kind of get a little more into the legal challenges we're going to see, first and foremost, these companies want to keep these cases out of court. They don't want to have to sit for discovery. They don't want to have to testify. They don't want to have the public looking at what they knew and what they did. They are going to rely heavily on trying to kill these cases before they even get to trial. They're going to argue that there is no standing. They're going to argue that anything having to do with climate is a political issue that is not right for the courts and should be handled in the elected branches of government. They are going to make all the arguments they can to delay this litigation as long as they can and keep it as far away from the public as long as they can. But the reality is courts are now, time and again, not accepting those arguments and saying, no, actually, we are the proper branch when a party has been harmed to adjudicate it and try to make a harmed party whole.
Hmm. Well, Corey Radé-White, it's been so informative having you on our show today. We greatly appreciate it. We want our listeners to be able to find the wonderful Center for Climate Integrity. Is it just centerforclimateintegrity.what?
Yeah, we have a brand new website that I'm really excited for everyone to see. It's climateintegrity.org. Yeah, you can see the documents we talked about here. You can learn more about the individual cases. You can sign up for updates. It's a great place to get all sorts of good information.
Thank you so much for bringing that information to us today and for telling us about the amazing and very necessary work of the Center. We thank you for joining us, really, on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals recently handed down a landmark decision in the case of U.S. v. Jamar Smith. It held that geofence warrants are, quote, categorically prohibited by the Fourth Amendment. So what are geofence warrants? Basically, they compel companies like Google to hand over data on every device in a particular geographical area over a set period of time. Not surprisingly, they are a controversial tool in law enforcement's investigative arsenal. Privacy experts argue that they amount to a dragnet search, violating the privacy of countless innocent individuals. Proponents, on the other hand, see them as a necessary tool in solving crimes in our digital world. The Fifth Circuit's ruling is therefore a major development in the ongoing debate over privacy and mass surveillance. Our guest today is Alan Butler, the Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, in Washington, D.C. EPIC has been at the forefront of legal battles to improve data protection standards to protect individual rights in our rapidly advancing surveillance state. Alan is chair of the Privacy and Information Protection Committee of the American Bar Association section on civil rights and social justice. Alan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Alan, can you please start by explaining what geofence warrants are and how often they're used? I've heard them described as reverse warrants, and what does that mean?
Sure. So the term geofence warrant refers to a request by a court-ordered request by law enforcement to obtain information from a company, either Google or perhaps a cell phone provider or other entity that has a large stored repository of information about the location of particular users' devices, to search through all of that data to find information about devices that were in a particular place at a particular time or at particular times. So the geofence warrant essentially asks the business to go through their data and essentially draw a geographic fence around a particular area and look at, again, specific time periods to see what devices were in that area at that time. So rather than searching a particular known safe deposit box or a particular home, when we think about the issuance of traditional warrants or issuing a warrants for seizure, arrest of a person or seizure of a person's belongings, this is a reverse warrant in that you don't know yet who you're looking for, but you know a place and time that you're looking for.
If I were at a rock concert in New York City with thousands of other people, that's a potential location that might be searched.
Correct. If you're at a large event, or if you happened to be, you know, crossing a particular street at a particular time, or even in, you know, to think about the radius of a geofence, usually it's not as narrow as, you know, few hundred feet. Usually you're talking about a several block radius, right? So in cities, and even in, you know, more rural areas, there could be tens, hundreds, thousands of people in a given place in a range of time.
U.S. versus Jamar Smith, Alan, the Fifth Circuit Court ruled, well, it's unconstitutional, they said. What was the court's rationale for their decision that these geofence warrants are indeed unconstitutional? And why is this opinion so significant?
Sure. So a lot of this links back to a major Supreme Court decision from 2018, which is Carpenter versus United States. And that was the first case in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that location data about cell phones is entitled to protection under the Fourth Amendment, even when it's being held by a cell phone provider. So the traditional rule from 50 years ago had been that records that are held by third-party businesses, individuals don't have essentially constitutionally protected interests in preventing the government from obtaining records held by businesses and not held by them personally. The Supreme Court in Carpenter said that when it comes to the type of rich and potentially sensitive data that's encompassed in individual's location history over time, there's a clear constitutional interest that's protected by the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And so the question in the Smith case that you mentioned in the Fifth Circuit was whether a geofence warrant is a permissible law enforcement order to obtain the type of information that we're describing with geofence data, or whether it runs afoul of the standards under the Fourth Amendment. Now, law enforcement does obtain warrants in these geofence warrant situations, as the name indicates. But the court in the Fifth Circuit focused on the fact that these warrants are general and broad in scope, and they're not tied to a specific individual known in advance. And the underlying history of the Fourth Amendment shows that the framers of the Constitution were animated by concern over the types of general warrants and general writs of assistance that were issued in England prior to the founding, that were used as essentially fishing expeditions to search for information about individuals without the necessary limitations and predicates. So the Fifth Circuit essentially found that geofence warrants are general warrants, or general searches that include and implicate many entirely innocent individuals, and that unlimited nature of those warrants violates the Fourth Amendment.
Alan, just a point of clarification on geofence warrants generally. Can they be for a protracted period of time? So, for example, if the Justice Department wanted to get records of people who were in, you know, a several block radius for a week, could they do that?
Well, the short answer to your question is that the practice of executing these geofence warrants is very new. The first geofence warrant attempts that we are aware of only go back to 2016, and there's no written statutory or other regulatory structure that governs geofence warrants. So far, the practice of executing and getting data under these warrants has been mediated between law enforcement and primarily like the FBI, but in other cases, local and state and local law enforcement, and the providers like Google. And so there has been a back and forth between those entities over the scope and nature of these warrants. And these cases that we're discussing now, the Smith case and another case in the Fourth Circuit, Chartree, are the first kind of times that we're seeing more higher federal courts grapple with some of these questions. But the Fourth Amendment certainly doesn't provide specific detailed answers to what is what length of time, what scope these warrants can be. And that, I think, is one of the issues we're grappling with here. And Congress hasn't filled the void with specific statutory rules about these either. And it's something that really the Supreme Court in the Carpenter decision in 2018 was really calling for, especially in Justice Alito's concurring opinion, where he was essentially pointing out that that decision was decided at on a particular set of facts at a point in time, but that doesn't answer a whole bunch of other questions exactly like the ones you're raising.
We now have a split among the circuits, given the case you just mentioned, U.S. v. Chartree, being decided by the Fourth Circuit recently, and that was related to the third-party doctrine. Can you briefly explain that and what the circuit held in Chartree?
Sure. So I think that the difference in approach between the Fifth Circuit and Smith and the Fourth Circuit and Chartree is really important to understand where we are in this phase of unpacking and applying the Fourth Amendment to digital devices. So what the Fourth Circuit in Chartree found essentially is that in the challenge of a geofence warrant issued to Google, the defendant in that case, Mr. Chartree, didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy because the data being collected by Google was collected as a result of the configuration and settings on Mr. Chartree's device. That essentially by having, quote unquote, opted in to location history within his Google settings, Mr. Chartree willingly exposed his information to Google, and that therefore he gave up any privacy interest that he had in that information. Obviously, the Fifth Circuit in Smith does not agree that the circumstances surrounding the settings within Google's location history lead to this conclusion that there is no privacy interest in that location data. And I think it's the case that the Supreme Court's logic in the Carpenter decision similarly undercuts that conclusion by the Fourth Circuit.
Well, then, Alan, that makes me want to ask this, and I suspect our listening audience wonders the same thing. We're not all practicing attorneys, and so this is technical stuff and important stuff to the privacy of the people of this country. There's this split now, as you've described it, between these two cases, which happen to have arisen in two different federal appellate circuits. So what is the practical effect of that? What if impact is that difference going to have on law enforcement searches? Let us understand this from a practical point of view, what this different opinions on similar circumstances, but not the same in these two cases means for the practicality going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add one additional point as part of my answer, the underlying background and factual circumstance in these two cases, I think, are very similar because they both involve geofence warrants issued to Google for the same type of data. So the split here is really stark. The Fifth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit are coming to polar opposite conclusions about the Fourth Amendment question when it comes to geofence warrants to Google for location history. And the implication of that on one practical level is that in the states that are that fall within the Fourth Circuit, which include Virginia and Maryland, for example, law enforcement have to follow one set of rules. They can go to Google and provide, well, I'll pause for one moment on what could happen under Chartree and say under Smith, law enforcement can't seek geofence warrants within the Fifth Circuit, which includes Mississippi and Texas and a few other states. In the Fourth Circuit, which again includes Maryland and Virginia, where Chartree was decided, not only can law enforcement seek a geofence warrant, but under the Fourth Circuit's logic, they don't even need a warrant. And that's the really stark difference, is that the Fourth Circuit is saying that there's no privacy interest in that location data, and therefore no warrant is required. Whereas the Fifth Circuit is saying that that data can't be obtained even with a warrant. So I think it's even a bigger circuit split than it might appear on first blush.
Well, Alan, things in this area seem to be getting confusing. As you mentioned, the landmark case of Carpenter in 2018, which the government said a search warrant was required to access historical cell site location records covering a period of more than 7 days. How does Smith fit into that scheme?
I think, as you said, it gets very confusing very quickly, which I think the court acknowledged in Carpenter would likely be the case, and we're seeing the ongoing consequences of that. I think in Smith, what we can glean is that the Fifth Circuit decided a geofence warrant, as they describe in that case, executed by Google or a company that has the same types of location data, is unconstitutional in all circumstances, regardless of the period of time that's being used to search it. And that is because of the way that underlying sensitive nature of the data and the way that that search takes place, which involves essentially querying the location of all users in the database.
And Alan, I wonder, how does the court's decision in Jamar Smith impact tech companies like Google, which are often at the center of such data requests?
I think this gets back to an earlier question that was raised about what's the practical effect of these two very polar opposite decisions in two different federal circuits, which is that companies have to respond to law enforcement requests, court orders, and are in a constant back and forth with courts and law enforcement about the scope and nature of those requests and what is required and what is permissible for them to do in response. And so Google and other companies that are receiving geofence warrants now, at least currently, have to have a special treatment of any warrants or requests that come out of the Fifth Circuit, out of states like Texas and Mississippi. They also would simultaneously have to respond to requests in Virginia and Maryland in the Fourth Circuit, and they have to answer the question for themselves about what do they do about requests that come in from other circuits where there is not yet a ruling. And this is really the consequence of indeterminacy in Fourth Amendment cases and the lack of, again, positive statutory law specifically on this question of geofence warrants.
And Alan, in a larger sense, the fact that the U.S. does not have a federal privacy law, and that right now we have really a patchwork among the states and even among different sectors, do you think it's getting to the point where this decision may prompt more robust legislative action at the federal or even state level to regulate the use of digital location data, as I think awareness of the impact on privacy is growing among Americans?
I think there is certainly a groundswell calling for action on multiple fronts for state and federal lawmakers to protect privacy. And EPIC, along with many other organizations, have been encouraging and supporting lawmakers that are trying to figure out how to write laws to address these issues. I do also think that there have been calls and there has been impetus to update specifically our laws concerning law enforcement access to communications and other types of data for more than a decade. And we're now 6 years past the Carpenter decision, where even the Supreme Court essentially called on Congress to enact some real positive rules there. The law governing access to telephone records and other electronic communications records was written in 1986 and hasn't been substantially updated since 1986. So that gives you a sense of how far behind we are in terms of our statutory protections and the unanswered questions about these searches.
Well, given the fact, Alan, that we don't have that statutory regulation at this point, we do have this split in the circuits and no decisions covering many of the other circuits in the country, what might be the next steps that will be taken by law enforcement agencies in response to these two rulings, or certainly in response to the Jamar Smith ruling?
You know, I think one of the really concerning things about the situation is that the answer to your question about what will law enforcement do in response to these decisions and others is that it depends on which type of law enforcement office you're talking about, right? In general, federal law enforcement agencies have a much bigger staff and a more robust legal oversight department. Smaller law enforcement entities operate on shoestring budgets and don't always have the type of up-to-date like legal compliance review that others do. And so some might be spurred by the Fourth Circuit decision to say, great, we can get a lot more location data without even asking for a warrant. So let's go out and just submit a bunch of geofence order requests, hope that the companies will respond to them and give us a lot more data that we can use in whatever way we see fit. Others might be more cautious and concerned that if they overstep, that they could have prosecutions at risk due to findings later on that they violated the Fourth Amendment. But an important, interesting distinction there is that a separate principle within the Fourth Amendment called the good faith exception really insulates law enforcement from those types of consequences, because courts tend to find if there's not clarity in what the law is, then essentially the tie goes to law enforcement and courts will assume that they relied in good faith on their understanding of the law, and therefore they can move forward with that particular case.
We have a few minutes left, Alan. From the perspective of consumers of electronic products, does the Electronic Privacy Information Center have any tips on how to protect privacy in light of the widespread use of location-based services and the potential for anyone's data to be swept up in a police investigation?
I think that in practical terms, for most users of electronic services and iPhones and other digital devices, you know, it's advisable not to turn off features that keep a composite comprehensive record of all your location. But we also recognize that as a practical matter, there are many services that require at least information about your location at a particular point in time to be useful, especially when you're talking about maps and directions, which is why we are really pushing for comprehensive data minimization rules that put strong obligations on companies to limit the data they collect and store so that they don't build these deep repositories of highly sensitive data that can then be mined later by law enforcement or others.
Alan, please talk in some broader strokes about the wonderful work that the Electronic Privacy Information Center and you do. What are some of the scope of that, or what are some of the more interesting and important aspects of your work currently?
Sure. So as you mentioned, my organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC.org, is a nonprofit research and advocacy center based in Washington, D.C. We've been here for 30 years fighting to defend the right to privacy for all online. And we do a wide range of activities, including interfacing with enforcement bodies and regulatory agencies that are trying to keep people's data safe and secure, working on public education around risks to privacy rights that stem both from commercial data collection and surveillance behavior, and also surveillance and data collection programs implemented by the government. We are concerned with issues of behavioral profiling of internet users, surveillance of citizens and other individuals within the United States and abroad, including advanced surveillance technologies like location tracking, as you mentioned, biometric face scanning, and other areas where there's clearly a need for greater protection of individuals and greater accountability for the powerful entities that build and operate these systems. And one other thing I'll mention that has been a core to our mission over many years is the need for transparency when it comes to both government and corporate behavior in this space. And this keys back to a question that was raised earlier about how many of these geofence warrants, if we take this specific example, are happening out there in the wild? And the short answer is we just don't know, because there aren't the necessary obligations for law enforcement to keep track of how many of these applications and warrants they're filing. It's an issue that we've highlighted over many years, that basically our data collection about law enforcement surveillance is outdated because it's focused on traditional telephonic warrants.
Before we let you go, Alan, I'm curious. To me, it seems as though the European Union's GDPR, or General Data Protection Regulation, has nudged the U.S. To do a slightly better job in holding corporations accountable for how they gather and what they do with Americans' data. Do you agree with that, and do you see that continuing to strengthen in the future?
Absolutely. We've seen a swell of attention by policymakers in the U.S. on the need for greater privacy protection, both following the rollout of the European GDPR in 2016, and importantly, following the adoption in California of a strong privacy law in 2016 that was amended in 2020. The creation of the California Privacy Protection Agency, for example, has spurred other states to try to do better. And the thing that my organization, EPIC, is really focused on is making sure that when states intervene, when states step in and try to improve their privacy laws, that they're actually writing laws that protect people's information, and they're not just writing laws that are handed to them by the tech companies to enshrine the worst practices in law.
Alan, how can our listeners follow your very important work and that of the Electronic Privacy Information Center?
Anyone can find our work on our website at epic.org. We also have a monthly newsletter called the EPIC Alert that you can subscribe to on our website, or use or share or see any of the resources that we post there, including information about cases, information about proposed policy proposals and regulations, and other important privacy news.
You're doing fabulous work. Thank you so much for joining us. And if there's another circuit decision, we'll be sure to call on you for commentary.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder. And I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show. And we'll appreciate that as well.